Hey, everybody, this is Carl Stern here, and I've got a couple questions for you. Do you ever get frustrated that you can't watch certain live sports events because they aren't televised or available in your country? With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a country that is showing the sports event you want to watch so you don't miss out and can watch the action live. You may have heard VPNs are great for online protection, but they slow down your internet speed. Luckily, NordVPN is the fastest VPN in the world. You won't even notice it's running, so you can stream and game online with no buffering or lagging. Furthermore, NordVPN prevents your internet service provider from bandwidth throttling, so you can have a consistently reliable internet connection. It's the price of a cup of coffee every month, a small price to pay for premium cybersecurity and access to a vast amount of entertaining content from all over the world. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/F4W to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan for 4 months free. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Let me tell you that link again. It's nordvpn.com/F4W.
How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
What's the matter, Lieutenant? Is this thing getting you?
Oh, no, no, I... Just thinking about public reaction to all this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to When It Was Cool Dark, or if you're listening over at WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com, this is Dragon King Dark. Thank you very much for joining me. This is episode number 343 of our podcast, and now that we're finished with Halloween, we took a month to do Halloween and horror-related shows. We're going to return now to our series called 100 Darkest Moments in Pop Culture History. And this is a series where we've looked at some of the most tragic, darkest moments in popular culture. That would be sports, that would be movies, TV, music, things of that nature. The things we cover over at whenitwascool.com. I hope you'll check out our website. And in this series now, this is part number 71. We've covered 70 previous dark moments in pop culture history, and we're back around again today to sports. And I know there are a lot of baseball fans out there. I myself am not personally a big fan of Major League Baseball. I find the game a little slow to follow, but I've always admired the sport because I think it's a sport that appreciates its history, appreciates its legacy. Its fans are some of the most knowledgeable fans in all of sports. I have a few friends who are very big baseball fans, and they can quote you statistics from way back in the day. They're from their favorite team or even the World Series, and I just get fascinated listening to people who are very passionate about something, very knowledgeable about something, talk about whatever their field of expertise is. And I hope that's what you feel through us. And I want to, you know, have that sort of sense of community with you, the listener. And so we're researching these dark moments in pop culture history. And I know a few people have kind of criticized this series for being negative and, well, dark, as is that's in the name of the podcast, right? But it is kind of a bummer. But these, I hope what this does do for you is maybe help remember these athletes, these musicians, these actors, actresses, the folks that have brought us entertainment, have brought us joy. And if there are people you didn't know about before, maybe you can learn something about their life and career. And so while I myself am not a big fan of Major League Baseball, I have a very healthy respect for it. And so when this opportunity came up, I really wanted to dive into it and take a look at it because baseball interests me as far as its place in popular culture. And I'm going to talk about a guy today that I knew nothing about, never heard of this fellow, Ray Chapman. He was mentioned as a possible topic for this series by one of our Patreon supporters over at whenitwascool.com. And so anybody that's a Patreon at When It Was Cool can suggest topics, can request topics, and I try to fulfill them. And so I got to looking at this and thought, yeah, this really is an interesting and dark moment in pop culture history for sure. Several shows back, or sometime in our previous 70 shows, I talked about the only National Hockey League player who was killed during a game. And hockey is a very fast sport. It's a very physical sport. And I was surprised to find out that only one person had ever been killed during the game of hockey in the National Hockey League. I expected it would be far more than that. And in fact, it probably would be far more than that had this death not influenced such change as far as safety goes. And the same can be said with NASCAR and the death of Dale Earnhardt Sr., which we previously talked about. The National Hockey League player was, by the way, was Bill Masterson, and that is from way back in Dragon King Dark episode 315. So if you want to listen to that, it's kind of apropos to go along with today's show, talking about Ray Chapman, the only Major League Baseball player to be killed during a game. And I thought, wow, you know, again, while baseball is not, you know, like a physical combat sport, you know, we expect some degree of significant injury in boxing or mixed martial arts or jiu-jitsu or wrestling or some physical combat sport like that where, something can go wrong or someone get too injured. Even NASCAR, you think these people are going, you know, sometimes upwards of 200 miles an hour. And, it's not unexpected that in a case of an accident, something could go fatally tragic. But baseball's not a combat sport. It is a physical sport. Speed, strength, and agility are all very important to baseball. But you've also got this small, very hard ball that, you know, some of these pitchers are throwing this thing upwards of 100 miles an hour at a guy with a bat swinging it to hit it. So, I mean, we know, hey, there have been tragedies in the stands at baseball games. Many times we've heard stories about, you know, people, in fact, even recently, trying to catch a ball and falling over, you know, the stadium ledge there, or getting hit with the ball out in the crowd. There have been people seriously injured with that. But surprisingly, only Ray Chapman so far has died from an actual incident during a game. So let's find out what happened to start with. Let's first, who is Ray Chapman? When did this happen? Well, Raymond Johnson Chapman was born January the 15th, 1891, and he died August 17th, 1920. He spent his entire career as a shortstop for the Cleveland Indians. So he spent his entire career there. We're talking about 1920 baseball. And what happened was Ray Chapman was hit in the head by a pitch thrown by pitcher Carl Mays. He died 12 hours later after being hit by the pitch. He is the only player to die directly from an injury received during a major league game. Now, as we talked about with our hockey death of Bill Masterson, as we talked about with Dale Earnhardt Sr. in NASCAR, this led to some changes. This led to some safety changes as well. It should have. They established a rule requiring umpires to replace the ball whenever it becomes dirty. Chapman's death and sanitary concerns also led to a ban on spitballs after the 1920 season. Chapman's death was one of the examples cited to justify the wearing of batting helmets. However, it took an additional 30 years to adopt the rule that required their use. But, you know, three decades it may have been, nevertheless, it was influenced by this. Before we dig deeper into the life and career of Ray Chapman, I want to take you to the Richland Source newspaper that has an article that was written back in well, it was earlier this year, 2022, Cleveland's Ray Chapman remains the only major league player killed on the field. And this is from the Ohio History Connection. Cleveland, on August 16, 1920, at the Polo Grounds in New York, Raymond Ray Chapman, star shortstop of the Cleveland Indians, stepped into the batter's box in the fifth inning to face surly New York Yankees pitcher Carl Mays. Mays had an unorthodox delivery in that he threw underhanded or submarine style and had a reputation of throwing at batters. Chapman had a tendency to crowd the plate, and on the third pitch of the at-bat on a 1-1 count, Mays threw a high fastball in Chapman's direction, striking him in the head. The sound of the ball coming off Chapman's head was so loud that Mays thought the ball had hit Chapman's bat, prompting him to field the ball and throw it to first base. Chapman's knees buckled, dropping him to the ground in front of home plate. Bloodied, he managed to stand up and began walking toward the clubhouse in center field, making it to second base before collapsing. Chapman was taken to St. Lawrence Hospital, but he would die 12 hours later on August 17, 1920, making him the only Major League Baseball player to die as the result of being beamed or hit by a pitch. Newspapers available through the Library of Congress, historic newspaper website Chronicling America, allow you to follow the story of Ray Chapman and read articles about his career, death, and funeral. Baseball was cherished by people during the time of Ray Chapman, and newspapers covered the happenings on the diamond extensively. The Cleveland Indians went on to win their first World Series just a few months later on October the 12th, 1920. The players agreed to donate Chapman's share of the bonus money to his pregnant widow, Kathleen Daly Chapman, a Cleveland native. Chapman told several people during the season that 1920 would be his last. He wanted to start a family and work for his father-in-law, the president of the East Ohio Gas Company. The tragedy of Chapman's death did not end on the field. Kathleen Daly Chapman, a once avid baseball fan, never attended another baseball game. She gave birth on February 27, 1921, to Chapman's daughter, Ray, but would eventually commit suicide from grief in 1926. The child, Ray, died from the measles in 1929. This story just gets darker and darker and worse and worse. The pitcher who threw the pitch, Carl Mays, could never endear himself to fans again, consistently blaming the accident on the condition of the baseball and swore unto his death that the pitch was an accident. Mays lost his life savings in the stock market crash of 1929 and later lost his wife to an eye infection, leaving him alone with two children. When Mays died in 1971, the headline for his obituary read, "Carl Mays, Yankee whose pitch killed batter in 1920, is dead." Wow, what a tragic story. I mean, it seems like nothing happy, positive, or in any way enduring occurred from that. Just a domino effect of tragedy from this. Hopefully it was an accident. I mean, we're led to believe by the language here that this fellow that threw the pitch, Carl Mays, you know, may have had a habit of throwing it at the batters before. Let's certainly hope that's not true. You avid baseball fans and historians, I'm sure, know more about that than me, and I don't want to in any way suggest that was the case. If it was not, you would know better than I. I'm just going by what the paper in the article said there. Chapman was born in Beaver Dam, Kentucky. He was raised in Herrin, Illinois. He broke into the major leagues in 1912 with the Cleveland team, then known as the Naps. Chapman led the American League in runs scored and walks in 1918. He was a top-notch bunter. Chapman is sixth on the all-time list for sacrifice hits and holds the single-season record with 67 in 1917. Only Stuffy McInnes has more career sacrifices as a right-handed batter. Chapman was also an excellent shortstop who led the leagues in assists once. He batted 300 better than three times and led the Indians in stolen bases four times. In 1917, He set a team record of 52 stolen bases, which stood until 1980. He was hitting .303 with 97 runs scored when he died. He was one of the few players whom Ty Cobb considered a friend. There was conjecture that 1920 was going to be Chapman's last year as a pro baseball player, as we heard in the previous article. Shortly before the season began, Chapman married Kathleen Daly, who was the daughter of a prominent Cleveland businessman. Chapman had indicated he was going to retire and devote himself to the family business in which he was marrying, as well as to begin a family. And when we come back, we're going to take a deeper look here at his death, and we'll take a look at another article from the Society for American Baseball Research, and which will have even more in-depth information. So since our second part of the show is going to be a little more technical and a little more in-depth about his actual death, we're going to take our mid-show break right here, come back and leave us a little more time on the backside. So let's take this quick break and come back and talk more about the only Major League Baseball player to be killed during a game, Ray Chapman. Hey, this is Carl Stern here for whenitwascool.com. Normally, you'd hear an advertisement right here for our website, whenitwascool.com. But I want to ask a special favor of you real quick. We have a survey up on our website. Very quick, 8-question survey. It takes about 1 minute to fill out. That's going to help us determine the direction for our entire website, including this podcast, for the coming year. So I ask if you would you go to whenitwascool.com, and there toward the top of the page, if you're on mobile or on desktop, you'll see a link to that survey. Would you please take a moment to take that survey? Again, it's only 8 questions, takes a minute or less to do, and it will greatly impact what we do at whenitwascool.com. Next year is going to be our biggest and best year yet, and I want you to get the content that you want. If we're doing something over here at whenitwascool.com that is, not to your interest, not to your liking, or we should be doing something that is, this is your opportunity to let us know. You, the listener, create the content, and this is your opportunity to have your say. Don't you wish other businesses did that? Don't you wish fast food places and car manufacturers would ask your opinion and actually go by what you say? Well, we will do that at whenitwascool.com. Go to whenitwascool.com, take our survey. Thank you very much. On August 16, 1920, Ray Chapman was struck in the head and killed by a pitch thrown by Carl Mays during a game against the New York Yankees at the Polo Grounds. At the time, pitchers commonly dirtied the balls with soil, even licorice, tobacco juice. They scuffed, sandpapered, scarred, cut, or spiked them, giving them a misshapen, earth-colored ball that traveled through the air erratically and intended to soften in later innings as it came over the plate. It was very hard to see. Mays threw a submarine delivery, and it was late in the afternoon. Eyewitnesses recounted that Chapman did not reach to the pitch at all, presumably unable to see it. The sound of the ball striking Chapman's skull was so loud that Mays thought it had hit the end of Chapman's bat. He fielded the ball and threw it to first base. Home plate umpire Tommy Conley noticed that Chapman was bleeding from his left ear, screamed toward the stands for a doctor. Tris Speaker, who had been on deck, rushed to Chapman, as did several players from each team. Carl Mays merely stood the mound. Chapman tried to walk, but his knees buckled. As he was helped off the field by his teammates, he mumbled, "I'm all right, tell Mays not to worry. Ring, Katie's ring," before falling unconscious. Chapman was taken to St. Lawrence Hospital, short distance from the Polo Grounds, where he died about 4:40 a.m. from brain damage. His pregnant wife, Katie, summoned from Cleveland by phone, arrived at 10 a.m. and fainted on learning he had died. Thousands of mourners attended Chapman's funeral at the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Cleveland. He was buried at Lakeview Cemetery. Cleveland players wore black armbands for the remainder of the seasons, and the Indians won the 1920 World Series and dedicated their victory to Chapman. A bronze plaque was designed in Chapman's memory, funded by donations from fans, and it was hung at League Park and was moved to Cleveland Stadium when the Indians moved there in 1946. Sometime in the early 1970s, however, it was removed for unknown reasons. In 2007, it was refurbished and made part of the Progressive Fields Heritage Park, which includes the Cleveland Guardians Hall of Fame and other exhibits from the team's history. Chapman had been inducted into the Team Hall of Fame in 2006, part of the first new induction class since 1972. A baseball field is dedicated to Ray Chapman in his hometown of Beaver Dam, Kentucky. Now, let's take a look at this very in-depth research here, article written by Joseph Wonko. August 16, 1920, Ray Chapman suffers fatal blow to his skull on pitch from Carl Mays, and this is from the Society for American Baseball Research. The 1920 American League pennant race was as tight as one could get. Three teams were within a half a game as the middle of August approached. Cleveland was in a virtual tie with Chicago. New York was a half game behind them and breathing down their necks. Cleveland hit the rails for its last swing through the Eastern teams in 1920. The trip would begin in New York and continue through Boston, Philadelphia, and Washington. The Cleveland Indians would play 15 games before heading home to face Detroit on September 3rd. The opener in New York on August 16th featured a dandy of a pitching matchup between Cleveland's Stan Kowalski and New York's Carl Mays. Both right-handers were at the top of their game, while using different styles to get the results. Kowalski used a traditional overhand motion, while Mays used a submarine-like delivery. It was said that Mays' delivery was so low that on occasion, his knuckles would graze the dirt on the pitching mound. Kowalski had two 20-win seasons to his credit, and it seemed likely that a third was within his grasp with 6 weeks left on the docket. His main pitch was the spitball, and although this type of pitch was outlawed by Major League Baseball beginning in 1920, Kowalski was one of 17 pitchers who were granted permission to keep throwing the spitball until he retired, since it was his main pitch. Mays had authored two 20-win seasons, 1916 and 1917, when he hurled for the Boston Red Sox. He was part of a deal that sent him to the Yankees on July 29, 1919. Mays had the reputation for plunking the batter, and at times the opponents would complain that it was his main pursuit instead of pitching. It was a gray and dreary day at the Polo Grounds as the game neared its 3 p.m. start time. The threat of the skies opening up did not deter the estimated crowd of 21,000 from pushing through the turnstiles. Indeed, the game started with light rain falling, which eventually tapered off after the third inning. Cleveland got on the board first. With one down in the top of the second inning, Steve O'Neill smashed his third home run of the season into the left field bleachers. New York had an opportunity to tie the score in the bottom of the frame. Ping Bodie led off with a single to the left field for the Yankees' first hit. Muddy Rule sacrificed to first baseman Doc Johnson, and Bodie moved to second base. Mays grounded one to Kowalski. Covey, as he is often called, threw to third baseman Larry Gardner to erase Brody. Aaron Ward fouled out to O'Neill for the final out. That was about as good a scoring threat as the Yankees mounted against Kowalski. Meanwhile, his teammates widened their advantage over New York. With one out in the top of the fourth, Gardner walked and went to third on a single to center by O'Neill. Johnson stepped into the batter's box and slapped a ground ball to shortstop Roger Peckinpah. Peck made a perfect throw to home to cut down Gardner, but catcher Muddy Rule dropped the throw, and Gardner scored to unearth a run. Bill Wongans grounded to Ward at third, but he fumbled the ball and everyone was safe. The bases were loaded. Kowalski skied one to Bodie in the center of the field plate to O'Neill to make the score 3-0 Cleveland. Ray Chapman led off the fifth inning, and the first pitch from Mays struck him on the left side of the head. He crumpled to the ground. Umpire Tommy Connolly, who was working the plate, immediately turned to the stands. He requested the services of a physician. Two responded to Connolly's plea. A silence came over the crowd as doctors worked on Chapman. Eventually, he was able to get to his feet with the aid of two teammates. He walked across the infield to the Cleveland clubhouse, which players accessed through center field at the Polo Grounds. But Chapman lost consciousness, and two teammates had to carry him into the clubhouse. Chapman was taken to St. Lawrence Hospital, half a mile from the ballpark, for x-rays. It was feared that he might have a fractured skull. A shroud of gloom fell over the ballpark. Players on both teams, as well as the fans in the grandstand, were unsure how serious the injury was. Chapman, who was one of the more popular players in the league, was badly injured, and it was reason enough for everybody to feel melancholy. Harry Lunt ran for Chapman. Tris Speaker then sent a grounder to second baseman Dale Pratt, who threw to Peckinpah to force Lunt. Back-to-back singles by Gardner and O'Neill enabled Speaker to score with the Indians' fourth run. Kowalski was having little trouble with the Yankees. He retired them in order in first, second, fourth, sixth, and eighth innings. Through eight frames, the Yankees managed only four hits. But in the bottom of the ninth, the Yankees staged a comeback. Babe Ruth led off and singled to right field, his only hit of the day. Pratt walked. Duffy Lewis, who liked Ruth and Mays, was obtained from the Red Sox, lifted a fly ball to the wall in left field. Charlie Jamison raced back to the wall and made a sensational grab for the first out. Wally Pipp grounded out to the first, and Ruth and Pratt each moved up a base. Both runners scored when Bodie doubled on a ball hit just inside the foul line in right field. Rule followed with a single past third base, and Bodie crossed the plate to cut the Yankees' deficit to just one, 4-3. Speaker jogged in from his center field position to have a talk with Kowalski. The right-hander assured Speaker that he was able to get the next batter and get the club a victory. Pinch hitter Lefty O'Doul hit a ground ball to short. Lunt went the short way, throwing to Wongentz for the forced out and the end of the game. But in spite of victory, the mood was somber in the visitors' clubhouse. The doctors at St. Lawrence operated on Chapman's skull around midnight, and he survived the surgery. Speaker contacted Chapman's wife, Catherine, who rushed to New York to be by her husband's side. She was late arriving, and Chapman died in the early morning hours of August 17, 1920. Outrage was directed at Mays, who was not a sympathetic figure. Players from the Red Sox and Tigers took up a petition demanding the American League president ban Johnson. The American League president was named Ban Johnson. So they demanded that ban Mays from playing baseball again. Mays contended that baseball was wet and it sailed on him. Furthermore, what was he going to gain in hitting Chapman with a pitch? Quote, "It is the most regrettable incident of my baseball career," said Mays. "I would give anything if I could undo what has happened. Chapman was a game, splendid fellow." Speaker said, "It is the duty of all of us, of all the players, not only for the good of the game, to suppress all bitter feelings. We will do all in our power to avoid aggravating the unfortunate impression in any ways." Chapman's funeral was held at St. John's Cathedral in downtown Cleveland on Friday, August 20th, 1920. Thousands jammed the church or stood outside on Superior Avenue. Johnson, who attended the funeral, decided to take no action against Mays. The Indians returned to Cleveland for the service. They went back on the road to Boston. They played two doubleheaders at Fenway Park. Boston took 3 of 4 as the Indians team undoubtedly played with heavy hearts. Mays went into seclusion for about 10 days after Chapman's death. New York came to Cleveland for a 3-game series in September, but Mays did not accompany the team. The Indians went on to win the American League pennant, the first in franchise history. They defeated the Brooklyn Robins in 7 games. Lunt, after replacing Chapman, pulled up lame and had to be taken out of the lineup. Cleveland acquired Joe Sewell from New Orleans of the Southern Association. Sewell went on to have a Hall of Fame career with both the Indians and Yankees. Baseball is littered with players who will be linked together in baseball history. Herb Score and Gil McDowell, Ralph Branca and Bobby Thompson, Pete Rose and Ray Foss, Kirk Gibson and Dennis Erksley. First and foremost, because of the circumstances, Carl Mays and Ray Chapman can be added to the top of the list. So a very, very detailed article from the Society for American Baseball Research. It's a very good-looking website. I'll have to do some more studying on the Society for American Baseball Research because, again, even though I myself personally not a big fan of Major League Baseball, it's always been one of those sports I've so admired the fans and the respect for history they have, the history of the various great ballparks. It's always been a game I've wanted to sit and maybe pick a favorite team. My state, my area doesn't really have a Major League Baseball team, so it's all, you know, pretty much whomever I would like to root for, I could pick me a favorite Major League Baseball team and kind of learn the sport and watch it. And I think it would be super interesting. And as I get older and have a little more time on my hands or whatever in the coming years, I may very well do that because I've always had very healthy respect for baseball. And I find it fascinating in a game where, you know, that's over 100 years ago, 102 years ago, that happened. And in that time, it's amazing that no one else has been killed. I mean, these Major League Baseball pitchers are, you know, throwing the ball at near 100 miles an hour. It's amazing that we haven't had more serious injuries than what has happened. So, you know, I guess whatever safety precautions they've taken over the years have, you know, had some effect, although it apparently took 30 years for them to start wearing batting helmets. And as we saw in with the death in the National Hockey League, they were super hesitant to do so as well. They were super hesitant to add helmets to the game and look down on any players that did wear them, even following that sport's only death on the ice. So it's a very interesting story, I think, and certainly an unfortunate one. Very sad the what happened to Ray Chapman, and it's a very sad story in the history of baseball itself. And in conclusion here, I wondered if Carl Mays ever spoke on the subject, ever thought, because again, everything we've seen so far certainly paints him as a somewhat unsympathetic character in this whole story, right? Especially if he was hitting batters on purpose and things like that. Is that even true? What's the story? Was he remorseful or whatever? And as it turns out, we do get his side of the story, at least to some degree. In the November 20th issue of Baseball Magazine, he gave an interview. And he actually gave I understand it was a written interview, I think, where he gives his thoughts on it. So I found an article from Medium.com from the sports section, published by Sports Raid, contributed by Andrew Martin, where it's transcribed. And this is the article giving Carl Mays' side of this very tragic story. And again, I mean, you know, Chapman's wife committed suicide. Their child, you know, died of a disease. It's just not a happy story to go around. Well, let's hear what Carl Mays had to say about this. Carl Mays discusses the pitch that killed Ray Chapman. The pitcher was responsible for one of the most infamous moments in baseball history. One of the most tragic events to ever take place on a baseball diamond was the 1920 death of Cleveland Indians shortstop Ray Chapman, who was hit in the head by a Carl Mays pitch in a game against the New York Yankees. Some thought the right-hander never showed any kind of remorse or visceral reaction he should have in light of the circumstances, which helped create a reputation that follows him to this day. However, he did go public shortly after the fateful pitch to talk about what had happened in the aftermath that ensued. Mays did not speak about the Chapman incident often, but there is a written record of his thoughts about his role and the ensuing reaction. Below are the excerpts from the interview are in italics, along with the author's reaction, this being the author being Andrew Martin, about what he thinks about what Chapman had to say. These quotes come from an interview he did in the November 20 issue of Baseball Magazine. Although Chapman's death was an accident, Mays became a scapegoat as a bad guy in the aftermath. Quote, A ball player is not often called upon to discuss his own faults. Usually those failings are played up behind his back, a certain courtesy forbidding their mention to his face. It would be foolish, however, for me to ignore the widespread criticism of which I've been the unwilling butt. For there have been weeks at a time when I could hardly pick up a newspaper without finding my own name assailed by writers, players, or owners indiscriminately. With Chapman's death being a first, it was likely a natural reaction to find someone or something to blame. Mays, who was known to be willing to let his fists speak for him, was an easy target. Obviously, he threw the fatal pitch, but there's never been anything to suggest an iota of intention behind it, and making him shoulder the blame was unfair. Mays was painfully aware that he was not a popular person. Mays is quoted as saying this: "It was long ago made very apparent to me that I was not one of those individuals who were not fated to be popular. It used to bother me some, for I suppose there are none of us who wouldn't prefer to be well thought of. But I was naturally independent, and if I found that a fellow held aloof from me, I was likely not to run after him. Evidently, I didn't impress people favorably at first sight. After they knew me better, I was generally able to be on friendly terms with them. When I first broke into baseball, I discovered that there seemed to be a feeling against me, even from the players on my own team. When I was with Boise, Idaho, I didn't have a pal on the club until the season was half over. Then the fellows seemed to warm up a bit, and we were on very good terms for the balance of the season." The author of the article then comments, "With 207 career major league victories, plus another 75 in the minors, and a 2.9 ERA, Mays had a career that should put him in the conversation for the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, the 6 votes he received on the 1958 ballot has been the extent of his support for inclusion. Mays used perceived slights against him to help fuel his success on the field." Mays went on to say this, quote, "My fellow players on the Providence team didn't seem to like me, and I wondered why. I've always wondered why I have encountered this antipathy from so many people wherever I've been. And I've never been able to explain it, even to myself, though I have one or two theories on the subject. I did get genuinely discouraged at Providence and, of course, feeling as I did, was unable to do good work. In fact, I lost all interest in my work. I wrote to my uncle telling him I had about decided to give up baseball. He is no doubt responsible for my being identified with the game at present, for he replied with a mighty stiff letter in which he handled things straight from the shoulder and without gloves. In brief, he told me that if I failed to make good, he would consider me a quitter, and that is a word I never like to take from any man. So I decided to brace up and see what could be done." The author then continues, "Even Mays' playing style set him apart from other players. He was renowned for his extreme submarine pitching delivery and thought nothing of standing up for himself when it came to his contract. He was also quick to temper and was once fined for throwing a ball into the stands and striking a fan in the head during a game. In an eerie premonition, Mays once joked he would have to get in trouble to get any true recognition in baseball." This is what Carl Mays said, quote, "I remember a conversation I had with my wife about this time in which I told her my baseball career had been singularly free from trouble. I said to her in a joking way that perhaps it would be necessary for me to do something out of the ordinary to get my name in the papers. But I needn't have been impatient, for could I have looked into the future, I would have seen trouble enough headed my direction to satisfy the most ambitious trouble seeker who ever lived." The author continues, "Mays was right on the money with this. Even though he had a career adjusted ERA plus of 119, which matches Hall of Famers like Warren Spahn and Bob Lemon, his accomplishments as a player are largely forgotten and overshadowed by his role in Chapman's death. Just because he didn't like to discuss it didn't mean Mays wasn't sorry about Chapman's death." Carl Mays said this, quote, "The unfortunate death of Ray Chapman is a thing that I do not like to discuss. It is a recollection of the most unpleasant kind, which I shall carry with me as long as I live. It is an episode which I shall always regret more than anything that has ever happened to me, and yet I can look into my own conscience and feel absolved from all personal guilt in this affair. The most amazing thing about it was the fact that some people seem to think I did this thing deliberately. If you wish to believe that a man is a premeditated murderer, there's nothing to prevent it. Every man is a master of his own thoughts. I cannot prevent it, however much I may regret it, if people entertain any such idea of me. And yet, I believe I'm entitled to point out some of the many reasons why such a view is illogical. I am a pitcher, and I know some of the things a pitcher can do as well as some of the things he can't do. I know that a pitcher can't stand on the slab 60 feet away from the plate and throw a baseball so as to hit a batter in the head once in 100 tries. That is, of course, assuming the pitcher actually wanted to hit the batter in the head, a thing which is absurd on the face of it. The author explains the bean ball is an unfortunate tradition in baseball, especially during the time of Mays and Chapman. However, there has never been any evidence that the pitch was thrown on purpose. In an age before video and instant replay, people across the country formed their opinion on this event based on past biases and imagination instead of facts. Even if Mays had been trying to hurt or maim Chapman, such an outcome would have been highly unlikely. Carl Mays says, quote, "But to actually kill a man, it is by no means sufficient to hit him on the head. Walter Johnson, with all his terrific speed, has hit batters on the head, and yet they have not died. Fairly often, a batter gets hit on the head and is seldom even seriously injured. There's only one spot on a player's skull where a pitch baseball would do him serious injury, and that is a spot about his temple, which is hardly half as big as the palm of my hand. Supposed to meet some of these malicious slanders that have been directed against me, we assume that a pitcher is enough of a moral monster to deliberately murder a batter at plate, a batter with whom he can have no particular quarrel and from whose death he could not possibly benefit. What chance would he have of perpetuating such a crime? He would have to hit that batter, and what is more, hit him on a particular part of the skull, a very limited area." In the aftermath, Mays didn't know what to do and took the counsel of others. This probably helped make things worse for him. Mays continued saying, "Almost everything I have done or haven't done since that time has been criticized. I have read newspaper comments which blame me for not going to the clubhouse to see how seriously Chapman was injured. The fact that I was a pitcher on the mound and had no opportunity to go to the clubhouse means nothing to these people. When I was finally taken out of the game, Chapman had already been removed in an ambulance, and it was too late for me to see him. I did not go to see Mrs. Chapman when she was in town. I could not, under the circumstances, bring myself to undergo this ordeal, though I would have done so if any good would have come of it. I did suggest doing so, moreover, to Colonel Houston, and he advised strongly against it on the grounds that it would be a trying experience for Mrs. Chapman. I was guided by his advice in the matter. I wrote to her, however. I did not go see Chapman after his death. I knew the sight of his silent form would haunt me as long as I live, and since no good would be accomplished from my going, I decided not to do so. It is possible I was mistaken in this attitude, but it was certainly through no lack of respect for Chapman or his friends. I have been bitterly criticized for pitching again so soon after this terrible tragedy. I can assure anyone who has made such a criticism that it was no easy task for me to take up my work where I had left it off." The author of this article concludes with, "This was pretty clearly a damned if he did, damned if he didn't situation. That being said, his decision to hold back and not reach out to Chapman or his family only strengthened preconceived notions that he was an uncaring jerk who may have thrown the bean ball on purpose." And, I mean, I think we can agree that he doesn't come off, you know, the most sympathetic figure here, even in this interview. He seems like a very self-victimizing person when the sympathy should be entirely upon Ray Chapman. He's very hyper-defensive of his own self and, you know, how dare you all judge me kind of attitude. But whatever the case may be, I don't know. Wasn't around in 1920. And for those of you who are baseball historians and have studied this sport, well, perhaps this is something that you have your own conclusions on, and I will leave you to those conclusions. But I found it to be a fascinating story. Ray Chapman, the only major league player in baseball history to have been killed on the field of play, and hopefully the only one that ever will be. So thank you very much for listening to our show, When It Was Cool Dark. This is one of the many shows on the When It Was Cool podcasting network. This show originally aired at whenitwascool.com, figure4online.com, wrestlingobserver.com, Dark Matter Digital Networks, and on our personal Patreon page on November of 2022. And coming up this week, we have shows on, we have classic book reviews coming up on whenitwascool.com. We have classic pro wrestling show history shows coming up. We have pro wrestling biographies. We have retro pop culture shows and much, much more. We cover pop culture. We cover retro pop culture, the history of pop culture at whenitwascool.com. I hope you'll check it out. And remember, for I want to encourage you, we're doing a survey right now, which is charting our course for the coming year. You, the listener, get to create the content. Now, you need to go now and take it. The survey is only good for 2 weeks. It's already been up for a few days. So if you don't do it right now, there's a chance the survey will have expired. It takes probably a minute or less to take it. It's only 8 questions long. But it is very important in helping us determine where we go in the coming year at whenitwascool.com. This is your opportunity to create the content you want to hear, see, and read. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you'll support us at whenitwascool.com by becoming a Patreon. And we will be back here next week with Dragon King Dark, When It Was Cool Dark, and continue as we get in the final days of our series, 100 of the Darkest Moments in Pop Culture History. Hey everybody, Carl here from whenitwascool.com. I've talked to you a lot about our Patreon, which is the most important way you can support us. But let me remind you of what else we do. You can follow us on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Grab the links off the front page of whenitwascool.com. Check out all of our free podcasts on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and other major podcast outlets. Check out Dragon King Dark, along with Stuck in the Desert podcast, Uphill Both Ways, Wrestling with the Dog, The Thrash Metal Show, Life and Times with KZ, our new show, The Plot, Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling Audio Show, Fireside Chat, and Heel Mustache podcast, plus many specials every month. Go to whenitwascool.com for everything retro pop culture and more. Hit that Patreon link for premium podcast content. If you're looking for something fresh and fun to listen to, then bookmark whenitwascool.com.